Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 154th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Hart Perez. I'm Matt Enloe.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have Kathleen Grace on the show. She is the CEO of New Form, a digital studio that Matt and I have both worked with. Matt did his Lisa Kudrow show for Refinery 29 with them.
That's right.
And I did Miss 2059 for them.
We go way back. We've got a lot of friends over at New Form. And Kathleen is, kind of leading the charge over there with innovating new and interesting content. But she's got an incredible history of coming up in digital media, and it's interesting to learn how her history at the forefront of this new media has really helped inform the way that she develops and runs a company.
Yeah, I mean, she's kind of like a media genius. We delve into like the entire story of like what made her who she is today. And even though it's like a lot of like, how did you get there that we talk about, I think it's all really fascinating and super relevant to today. I think people will pick out a lot of really cool tips.
And I think the main lesson, the thing that Kathleen embodies and like continues to teach us over and over again, is that in circumstances where things feel uncertain or things are changing or new, there's opportunity. And she's living proof that that continues to be the case, and she's managed to seize those opportunities over and over again. So there's plenty to learn from Kathleen. There's so much, in fact, that I think we're going to forego our catch up one more time. But we'll learn all about what Oren and I are doing next week. But we do have an iTunes review.
B-Man1205 says, great pod, 5 stars, wonderful guests and useful info.
Hey, thanks, B-Man. If you want to help the show grow, if you want to support the community for free, be like B-Man, hop onto iTunes and drop us a review. It is the number one way that you can help the show grow and build the community even more.
And if you want to support the show not for free, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/justshootitpod. You can give $1, $2, $4, $20 per month. We have a few of those.
It's pretty cool.
We just use that money to pay our editor and to do live shows and to get better equipment and do all the things that help keep this podcast alive. I have to bribe my wife now to let us record at home every night.
Your continued support helps bring in guests like Kathleen and Carrie and David and, program out special slates like our development 4-part series and also our live events and more series just like this. So we really appreciate it. Patreon.com/justshootitpod. Throw a couple bucks into the bucket. Helps everything.
Thanks, everyone. And thanks for listening. And keep writing us. We just got an email from someone saying like, hey, you said you don't know who your listeners are. And it's helpful, so do it.
Yeah, and also, Oren and I work hard on the show. We've spent a decent amount of time on it, and it's genuinely nice to hear that you listen. So thanks, everyone.
With that, let's just get to our guest, Kathleen Grace. Hello, Kathleen Grace. So usually we don't kind of do break-in stories, but we were wondering what yours is in a nutshell.
I originally, out of college, moved to New York to work in off-Broadway theater, and I was working in a ticketing box office.
Wait, did you go to film school?
No, I went to undergrad. My parents would never have let me do that.
Smart.
No, I got a liberal arts education. It's not like I decided then to be a doctor. I went to McGill in Montreal.
Oh, cool.
Which was awesome. That was actually a great thing they made me do. I know I wanted to do it, but a great thing my dad suggested and ended up being amazing.
But are you Canadian?
No, okay. I'm from Texas. I just wanted to get out of Texas. mm-hmm. badly. And cool. Montreal was cool. An 18-year-old drinking age in French.
And very different from Texas.
And very different from Texas.
Yeah.
So I graduated. I moved to New York to work in off-Broadway theater. I was like directing off-Broadway, like at a little theater company. And I was working in this ticketing box office. And I'd been in New York for maybe like 3-4 years. When I suddenly realized like, oh, I don't know if I actually want to direct theater because I will, one, have to wait for an old white man to die. And then even if he does, I don't want to direct Broadway musicals. Mm-hmm. So I was like, what am I doing?
Right. Like, that's the big time. That's the goal.
The
right?
goal. I don't yeah. even want the goal. Right. And so I realized I really liked working with actors, writing, and that collaboration process. And I was like, oh, well, I could do that and not do theater. Like, I could do TV or film. And at the same time, I had this soul-sucking box office job where I literally worked in a bank vault. Like, this off-Broadway theater in New York has a bank vault as the ticket office window. Mm-hmm. And so, like, no light of day, mm-hmm. in front of computers all day, selling tickets to Upper East Side rich people.
Do you get to, like, swim in the gold coins?
I wish there were no gold coins.
Wait. So this isn't, like, I heard, like, the version of the story where I was thinking, like, oh, you're in, like, a cute, like, Brooklyn small theater.
No, it was, like, 43rd and 8th.
You're, like, at, like, TKTS or something like that.
Or just it was
like,
Second Stage Theater, which is a nonprofit off-Broadway theater that now actually has a Broadway house. And it's cool. Like, I got to see really cool plays and worked with nice people, but it was soul-sucking. This was right when the internet started to be like a thing. I mean, mm-hmm. the internet existed, but it started becoming right. like people had
Al
Gmail.
Gore had just invented it.
And like you would have internet at work. You mm-hmm. know, you would already have the internet, but you would have like hours of sitting and like surfing the internet. Like people didn't surf the internet before. They would just like hang out in AOL
right.
chat
they,
rooms.
They'd check their mail.
Yeah. And this was like 2005-ish.
This is the dawn of web series, basically.
Yeah. And like they did not exist at this point. YouTube did not exist at this point, just to set the stage. And I started watching a lot of weird videos on this website, Channel 101, mm-hmm. with my coworkers.
What was your series? What did you like?
Well, the first thing I distinctly remember watching is House of Cosby's.
Yeah.
Which was amazing. And everyone should immediately Google House of Cosby's and shit themselves laughing.
In New York, so funny. They do Channel 102.
And there was this kid doing Channel 102 who was friends with this girl, Becky Yamamoto. I don't even remember the guy's name. I just remember emailing Becky and being like, Becky, who's this guy? Who does Channel 102? Right. I need to know more about this. And I was working with this guy, JJ Shabesta, who is like the one who introduced me to all. And he's now like a director, worked for The Onion for a while, whatever. And I looked at this guy's website and I had recently built a website for my own theater company. And I was like, not really knowing who Dan Harmon was or any mm-hmm, of the context, mm-hmm. I was like, fuck that guy. I can build a website. I don't need him to.
And just for our listeners, Dan Harmon created Channel 101 and then Community and.
Yeah. I did not know that he was. Like, right, and at this point, he wasn't really like.
He wasn't.
A famous
he
TV
wasn't
writer.
Famous
yeah, yeah.
until.
Yeah. And like, pretty much. The Lonely Island guys weren't the Lonely Island guys. Like, they were kind of there. It was like all in the soup.
Did you know the Waverly Flams guys? Waverly
yes.
Films guys? They were like kind of early on then too, making just like.
Cool, really videos. Cool videos.
Yeah. You would watch, basically, if you could watch a sketch group's QuickTime videos, that's your early, like your pre-YouTube, basically.
Well, they were doing like 48-hour film festivals and then putting their
stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
Totally, yeah. I started following those guys and I was like, well, I don't need someone else's permission to build a website. Mm-hmm. I know how to build a website. Not really thinking through that, I did not know how to do video encoding or hosting or any of this shit. I was like, okay. And at the time, I had lived in Williamsburg and then couldn't afford to live in Williamsburg and was living in Harlem and was very, like, bitter about Williamsburg hipsters. And so I was like, we should make a sitcom about the gentrification of Williamsburg. And at the time, also the, like, Always Sunny thing had happened. Mm-hmm. Like, the guys had, like, self-funded their own pilot. And so I approached my friend Tom Woodley through a friend of mine because, one, I knew that he was, like, a writer, but he also had a car. Mm-hmm. And I was
Which in New York is, like,
it's a big deal.
Big deal.
Sure.
Yeah. And I had come up with, like, kind of loosely what the characters were and generally what we would do. And the idea was, like, oh, we'll just, like, shoot a pilot. And in the parallel to this, I left my box office job and started working in independent film, like, PAing and stuff. And because I was like, I'm going to do this film thing and TV thing. And so I told him, and he was like, well, my friend Matt should work on it. And the three of us started developing it and writing it. It ultimately became called The Burg, and it was a satire of Williamsburg hipsters. And we were mid, and Tom was very smart and was like, well, if we're going to shoot one episode, because he had done some AD work, he was like, let's block shoot and shoot a bunch. So we borrowed basically $5,000 from my parents. And I had borrowed money for them when I started my own theater company and managed to like pay them back. And so I was like,
oh, nice.
I was like, yeah. This is a sure bet, Mom and Dad. Yeah. Like, I can pay you back.
Right.
And so we filmed, we wrote, and mostly Tom and Matt, and I was like kind of producing and directing it. They wrote three episodes, each around 15 minutes. I don't know why we decided that. It was like a completely arbitrary choice. I think Tom was like, yeah, let's make them 15 minutes and show them that we can make more than one episode.
Sure.
Which is dumb because we should have just done a fucking 22, whatever. Yeah. Like, in retrospect, I was like, why?
Well, even
we
though
that?
Now, today, I feel like
that would have been smart.
15 minute is like, it's fine.
It's fine. Exactly. And we block shot the three episodes, and in the midst of editing the three episodes, and this is like, it took us forever, like, to do all this.
Sure.
Right, you're cutting the film, splicing it together.
Well, we shot on Panasonic DVX-100s, like these mini DV 24p. And we cast all these people, like, from our friends and kind of the UCB world. This guy Mike Still is in the pilot. This guy Joe Randazzo is in the pilot. I think in our first episode, we ended up casting this woman, Kelly Yiddish, who at the time was in All My Children and is now on Law and Order Special Victims Unit. But she just wanted, like, that was my big revelation through that process, was like, please cast soap actors because they are really good at hitting their marks and they want to do anything but the soap kind of stuff. So like she was,
and they can glance at their pages and be ready to go.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. If you give them a second take, they're like,
and they have a built-in fan base.
Right. Interesting.
Okay.
Yes.
And then we also built this whole mechanic. I was like, every episode will be scored by a local indie Brooklyn band. Those two details are kind of important later on. And so all of this is like on the weekends, and my friend Anna is like editing it while she secretly on the final cut system of this independent film she was making with Willem Dafoe. Like, and I'm like, I'm working on another independent film, and this is all happening. And then YouTube becomes a thing. Like it had launched in 2005, but like no one really knew about it till 2006. And we're in the middle of editing it. And I'm like, oh, there's this YouTube thing, but our episodes, I was like, maybe we should just put our stuff on the internet. And like, maybe we should put it on YouTube, but it's too long for YouTube. So let's make six shorts that can go on YouTube that can drive traffic to this website I'm going to buy or build. And so May 24th, 2006, we uploaded our first short with the idea that we post one short a week on YouTube for 6 weeks leading up to the launch of our website. Like, anyone fucking cared. But this is my whole cockamamie speech.
Yeah, but this is in the days when like 500 views is like a jackpot.
Yeah,
right? Totally.
Even you saying driving traffic like brought back memories.
Yeah.
You know, like.
And so May 24, 2006, we put this 45-second short called Hip or Dangerous on YouTube. And literally 6 weeks later, I'm in the New York Times. 6 months later, we're in Wired magazine. Like there's a New York magazine article. It's like, who are these fucking kids? And they're making a sitcom in their spare time. And I was insane. I have a distinct memory of like, we all made these episodes. No, everyone worked for free. And I was like, I remember we like all got together one Thursday night or something. And I was like, you know what the fucking trick is, guys? We just keep doing it. We don't stop. Like a mad person. Like, I'm like, what? In retrospect, I'm like, who did I think I was?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think you were Logan Paul or something? Come on.
So then we did that. And basically flash forward. And this is all like I had. Like we were crazy. Like Tom was working at an ad agency. I was working on. At a certain point during this whole process, I worked on The Wrestler. I worked for Darren Aronofsky. Like, I was working.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I worked on
TV shows.
Like,
that guy's not paying anybody. I can, too.
Is he known for not paying?
The Black Swan internship lawsuit.
Was right.
And then, so, we're all working crazy hours. And then eventually around, I think we launched in 2006. Midway through 2007, I get this cold email from Michael Eisner.
Who was the CEO of Disney at the time?
He had left.
Oh.
He had already started Bugaroo, but he was still like a name brand.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Like, he hosted the wide world of Disney for childhood.
But I guess our younger listeners might not know who he is at all.
Oh, yeah, you're
today.
Right. People would
Yeah.
Know.
Or even what the wide world of Disney is.
He hosted a Sunday movie night where they show Disney movies.
Right.
Yeah, but he was also the CEO of Disney.
But also when you think about that, like, how ridiculous is that? He's the CEO of the company. Funny. He's like, guys, I have an idea.
Oh, he hosted it while he was the CEO?
No, but that's because of Walt would host that show.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and it was like, it was like the Disney vault. It was like you couldn't watch those movies or shorts or anything.
And so I get this cold email and I'm like, this is crazy. And I like text.
Wait, what does it say?
And it's like, I want to meet with you. I love your work.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, wow, okay. So
you're like, there's probably a lot of Michael Eisners out there.
And I email Tom, and Tom and I are like, what are we going to do? And I literally go to the call sheet of the movie I'm working on at the time, and I look up the lawyer, and I cold call her, and I'm like, you don't know me. I've delivered paperwork to your office, but I just got an email from Michael Eisner, and I think I need a lawyer before I go into that meeting.
Like, I did not know this part. This is incredible.
That's pretty smart.
And she is, to this day, a very good friend and my entertainment lawyer.
Awesome.
And by the way, that's like a pretty hot tip that we've never heard on the show
before.
Yeah,
good takeaway.
Episode 154. Like, if you need someone,
a lawyer in a pinch,
that might be on a call sheet, look at a call sheet.
And my biggest recommendation to anyone breaking into production, and even if you want to be on the creative track, work at least one job as an office PA, because I literally, I don't know if this is okay, but stole all the contracts from gig.
Contracts. I thought you were going to say contacts.
And contacts. Like, I would just save every contact sheet, every call sheet. I would save every contract. I used every...
And then what, you blackmail the actors?
No, I'd like white out the legal entities and make them my own legal entity so that I didn't have to pay a lawyer to draft production contracts.
Right. Because it's when you're pretty boilerplate.
Yeah. Like, and you just are like, oh, okay, I can use this and read everything.
That were those weird smudges on my new form contracts.
Exactly. To this day.
Yes. It's like, Oren Aronofsky. Sure.
Great. So we go to this meeting. It's very strange.
You meet him in person.
In person. He has an apartment at, what hotel is that on the upper, near the Central Park, on like the Upper East Side? I'm not going to remember, but he has like the whole floor. Like,
right.
Yeah. And you walk in and there's like, you turn and there's like a ridiculously expensive piece of artwork on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Right, Picasso. And Picasso's
Rembrandt.
There like
something like
finishing
that.
It up.
It was something like name brand.
And also like a Mickey Mouse.
So Tom and I sit down, Michael sits down, and he's like, whatever you want to do next, I'll fund. And I'm like, what? And we had kind of been like, we should have some pitches ready.
Sure, sure.
And so we were like, oh, well, we kind of want to make this mockumentary about an indie rock band. And the reason we pitched this was like, I knew that Michael Eisner had made the Monkees. Mm-hmm. And I was like, he'll probably like something that's like the Monkees that reminds him of when he was a young executive at ABC, because he greenlit and produced The Monkees.
Right, which was a show about a band.
About a band. And also, it was right when MySpace was huge. And so we were like, and we can distribute it on MySpace.
Right,
and he had just made this deal with the show Prom Queen and just did a distribution deal with MySpace on it.
And
we were like, this
was like
perfectly keyed to his strategy.
He was buddies with Tom, probably.
Yeah. And he was like, I love it. Let's do it. And I was like, oh, cool.
You're like, would you do it for like 10,000?
Basically, I was like, so you're gonna give us money?
Yeah.
And then we spent about the next, I will be honest, it took like 8 months to negotiate that deal.
Sure.
And like,
which is not unheard of.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know that at the time. I was like, this is so torturous. Yeah, and the whole time we're like still making the Berg, and he wants to buy the Berg outright from us. And I'm like, I don't feel great about that.
And did this lawyer come with you or help you in
that first meeting? No, but she negotiated the whole deal.
Everything. Oh, cool.
Yeah, now you're like, oh, I've got a deal on the table with Michael Eisner.
Yeah, like, and also because of this, we like met with CAA, we met WME, we did all the agent meetings, and there's really funny stories about that. We're like, because digital was like hot.
Sure.
We were like hot for a moment. This all happens. We end up making the show, The All for Knots. It is a mockumentary about an indie rock band. We record an album, and we make basically 300 minutes of content, a full-length album, 12, and we cast and create this band for $500,000. And it, for me, at 27...
You think that's the most money...
Ever.
It's an insane amount of money.
In fairness, it probably was the most amount of money a digital show got at that time.
For sure.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, it's still a ton of money.
Basically 2.5 feature films and a full-length album for $500,000. And, like, controlled all the rights. Yeah. Like, super aggressive. Like, our contracts for those actors were, like... because of what Eisner wanted, they were, like, American Idol contracts. They were so aggressive. It was like, we are going to pay you $150 a day.
Sure.
We're going to put you in this band. And if one song is a hit, we own you for life. Right. Like, it was really aggressive.
Wait, so you cast the band. They didn't know each other. It wasn't a real band.
No, it was a totally cast band. We put it together.
Simon Cowell bit.
Yeah.
Do you recall how you came up with the number 500,000?
Like
why?
We had like budgeted our own shoots, and like I knew from the Berg, in the midst of this, we got a deal from Motorola to do 9 shorts. Mm-hmm. And so we finally had budget. So I negotiated a SAG New Media deal before there was a SAG New Media deal with East Coast SAG.
Yeah.
And so I knew roughly how fringes worked and like... all of that. Tom had done enough A-Dean and like his own stuff. Right, you
should kind of piecemeal together.
In retrospect, it was not enough money.
Sure.
I mean, like I made no money. And in making that show, ultimately, between that and the Berg went $25,000 in personal credit card debt.
Right. Right. Of course. But also, you're like, Mom and Dad, like the New York Times just wrote about me.
Totally. So they kind of got it, but they were like, maybe you could just get a job.
Right. Right.
Because like, I kept like doing production, and then I would like, I worked for Darren for maybe 9 months and I left because I was like, I have to go do my second half of my shoot for my thing for Eisner.
Right.
And he was like, good luck. And then, so I made this show that was all exciting and really cool.
What was that show called?
The All for Knots.
Oh, right. The All for Knots.
So, and we like continued making episodes of the Berg along the way. Mm-hmm. And then 2008 happened.
The crash.
I got dropped from CAA, and they like never told me.
Well, your rep left, and then
they just never managed to like.
It was just
communicate
that. Yeah,
which also is not unheard of.
No, right? But at the time I was like super emo about it. What's gonna happen to me?
Yeah.
You know, because they convince you that they are the key.
But let me ask you,
everything.
You were like Michael Eisner's like. Personally emailing you, you're going to his apartment, he's telling you he'll fund anything you want, you're written up in the New York Times. Did CAA do anything for you that you couldn't have done on your own?
In the midst of all of this, between the Berg and the Motorola deal and the All for Knots, Tom and I made a deal with this company called Video Egg that doesn't exist anymore. And I don't know what they were. They were like a video distribution system, and they set up brand deals. Like, it now all seems very not like a business. But then at the same time, elements of it are businesses that exist today in other names.
Right.
So you're like, they were on to something. They were just way too early.
Yeah. But branding, like maybe was there like a shopping element as well? Like maybe you could like...
Yeah.
The character wears the jacket in the series and you can buy that. Something maybe like something like that. Yeah.
And... we made a deal with them to do another series. I can't even remember what it was. Oh, it was a thriller mystery set in a college campus. And CAA knew that Video Egg was working with a brand on it. Mm-hmm. And this is by far the most, I use this as an example of like what you want your agency to do and why it is good to have a kind of bigger agency potentially. They knew that Sprint, who was the brand, was going to fire their agency. Because they were repping Sprint as a retainer client.
CAA was.
Yeah. Which is like, who knew they do that? They still do that to this day. And so they had like inside information. They didn't tell us this inside information. So they didn't like violate any non-disclosure agreements. But they heavily negotiated for our deal to be pay or play.
Mm.
Which in the world of brand entertainment is like bonkers that they pulled that off.
Yeah.
But they were like, you got to give these guys pay or play. They got a lot of shit going on. And if you can't make this happen, Video Egg, like, you better pay them out.
And for our listeners, pay or play, if you don't know, it means that you signed a deal, and even if you never end up making whatever...
you get paid your full amount.
Or sometimes, and they can be like a 50% too,
right? Yeah, and you basically, 10 days before you're supposed to go shoot this thing, Sprint fired their agency and pulled the project. But Video Egg had agreed to this pay or play agreement.
Right. So you bankrupted Video Egg.
No. We then spent like 3 months negotiating it, and I think we got like half of it. But it was super meaningful. It let us open an office. Mm-hmm. It let us, like, it gave us the runway to allow us to do all this stuff. And so, like, that was huge. Like, CAA, yeah, like, paid for themselves there.
Right.
And also, they gave up their commission on the All for Knots because we had brought it in before we signed with them.
Gotcha.
But and did they bring you the new egg, the video egg deal?
No, or? they didn't bring us any of the deals.
So they negotiated. Okay.
Yeah. And that was helpful. And right. I think anyone who expects their agent to get them work is dumb.
Right. Well, that's the thing.
Just disappointed, maybe.
Well, I know we bring that up on the show a lot, but I just think it's like you can't say it enough because we have so many people write to us and they're like, yeah, I'm trying to get an agent. I'm trying to get a manager. I'm trying to get this. You know, I feel like I'm ready for the next level. You know, it's one thing if they're like, I have this deal and I want someone to negotiate right. it. And it's another thing if they're like, I just feel like I'm ready for more work, you know, so I need an agent.
They won't do that for you.
Yeah. And so it's like just the example of like, you're like one of the top digital creators in the world at this point, and CAA still is not, and we're the best agency in the world.
One of the first, right? Like the players at this point are, it's very few people who are in this marketplace yet.
Yeah. It's like me, the Rocket Boom guys.
Sure. Yeah.
And the Duder guys, Matt Kirsch. Yeah. So Duder, The Berg.
There's all the people at Super Deluxe.
Four Eyed Monsters. Remember that? Mm-mm, it was no. like this semi, not scripted, but it was like a semi-autobiographical drama about this couple making a movie about their relationship. So it was like not scripted, but felt scripted. Mm-hmm. It was super fucking crazy and really weird. And they were like, it was weird. You're like, this is weird. But I was addicted to it. I was like, I want to watch this couple in, like, incinerate themselves by making a movie together. It was so amazing.
Well, and also there's like that electric feeling of like, oh, we're on the brink of something new.
No, and it definitely like felt that way. Yeah.
But there was also at the same time all these companies saying like, we don't trust these people. Like, why would we spend money? I remember I was pitching like digital videos. We had I'm good friends with a guy that made this video called Shoes.
Oh yeah,
Kelly Shoes. Love. Yeah. So we took him to K-Swiss and we're like, hey, look at this video. It's like the number two most viewed video on YouTube. We'll make a video. We'll do Shoes with for K-Swiss. Let's do it. And then the CFO of K-Swiss is like, I could put a commercial on during the Lakers game and see like, you know, have it be seen by like 20 million people. Like, why would I put a commercial on YouTube?
Yeah, that was weird. Then also I had weird conversations when we did the Motorola sponsorship with Berg, where the like, it was like almost done and Video Egg had set it up. And at the 1 yard line, Video Egg was like, I was working at this point. I was like someone's assistant. They called me in the middle of the day and they were like, you need to get on the phone with the creative director of the agency. Like, if you don't do this, the deal doesn't go through. And I was like, well, and I like told my boss, I was like, I'm really sorry. I gotta do this. And I get on the phone and the creative director guy's like, how do you do it? I was like, what? And he was like, how do you do it? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, make it look so good for so little money.
Sure. I mean, it's a magic trick, right? Like, some of it is like,
yeah, well, generational,
right?
Well, I was like, smug, shitty 27-year-old bitchy Kathleen answer was like, well, I don't have a house. I'm fucking Greenwich.
Yeah, like, but true. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and I think that it's also like, look, technology lined up perfectly with like your ambitions. And but there is also, you know, a bit of a handicap with like, oh, this is the right way to do things, right? You know, yeah. Like this preconceived idea of like what it means to do it right and what good means and what it takes to do something that looks good or professional or whatever. And like, we didn't know what that was necessarily.
Yeah, I knew just enough to make the people working on The Berg or whatever feel like, oh, this is a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, I knew just enough to be dangerous.
Right.
And then I knew.
But you were also young, and everyone you were working with was young. And so it's like, you don't we need were having to make. Fun too. You're not worried about, yeah, mortgages or preschools or whatever.
Yeah. And then I knew. Like, I didn't know enough so that I would do things the broken way. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember showing one of my bosses at the time, like, a call sheet and how we shot The Berg and how it was – we shot it as a three-camera shoot.
Mm-hmm.
There'd always be two cameras and a rolling camera that, like, either Tom or I would take or I would boom. And like, I also showed her how many pages we shot and how we didn't get location permits and how we run and gunned the whole thing.
Right.
And she was like, you do 18 pages in a day.
That is a lot of pages.
And yeah. I was like, and she's like, can you do a 3-camera version of this? I was like, well, that was like an insane day and it was all available light and like,
right.
Like none of this was locations. It was all, there was this episode training day where we wrote, had the characters ride from Brooklyn to Queens because the G train was down and they needed to get whatever. But like, so that was like a day when we were like, we need to shoot out this episode in basically 2 days. And we had to do, I think we did like 15 pages, something insane. But I didn't know that that was crazy.
Right. Right.
Like I was like, oh, well, yeah. Like if you write the story the right way and you get everyone bought into it mm-hmm. and you really restrict how many characters there are and how many locations, like she just couldn't understand that like I could do that. I was like, mm-hmm. We all work together to make it so that we can accomplish it in the time that we can and with the resources that we have. And everyone's on board with that.
Right.
And that kind of blew her mind as a traditional television person. She was like, how do you get people to do that? I'm like, you ask them.
Right.
And you say please and thank you and you let them have creative weigh in.
Right.
Like you don't make everyone just a cog in the wheel. You just say, what's your opinion, sound guy?
Right.
Like, do you think we should do it this way or like?
Yeah. Yeah. But you also have a network of people that you're working with.
That right? are willing to do it.
Yeah. That yeah. you know.
And also, you know, we'd make jokes about getting paid and exposure. But like back then it was
actual exposure.
And like the metrics that you were looking at were blowing people's minds, right? Like now, yeah. like getting thousands of views on something, you know, is so much more commonplace. Back then, like it's just, you couldn't wrap your head around it.
There were only like a few thousand people watching videos
online. At one point, we were getting hundreds of thousands and millions of views on our website.
Right. On your website.
Not YouTube, on our website.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. That's what a lot of the debt was the hosting costs.
Oh, right, because really? That's when yeah, you have to sure. pay for your bandwidth, right?
Not smart on my part.
Yeah.
Although in retrospect, I'm like, 500,000 views, who cares? That's right. The crazy thing right. about YouTube now. Like, at New Formway, this tech stories thing, and we crossed something like 1 billion views after like 4 months or something.
Yeah.
And we like made a big stink about it internally, and then we tried to make a big stink about it externally. We were like, 1 billion views! And people were like, shrug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, 1 billion views is a lot of views. Come on, guys.
No, but I think shrugging is a good thing. So, ask the kids. It's like a, it's like a cool move, dance move. So
the economy bombed out and I no more agent. No one was buying digital content. And I kept trying to pitch TV shows. Mm-hmm.
Like to network traditional.
To traditional. And it wasn't working for me creatively.
They also still, I mean, there's still a little bit of stigma on digital, but like back then,
oh yeah,
it was like a preschooler was walking in to yeah. be like, oh, like I, trust me, I know how to make TV shows. Yeah. They don't care. Yeah.
Well, and also I kept doing what ultimately I think ends up serving me in the long run is that like I kept going in and being like, here's the show. Here's the entire marketing plan. This is the future. Mm-hmm. Like I over, like mm-hmm. I tried to change their whole business model.
Right.
While also pitching right. them a TV show instead of just
you pitch them the creative and the business,
yeah,
as opposed and that, to just the creative
instead of just the creative, and that ultimately I think threatened them. I don't know, or they were like, "Who's this crazy person? And why isn't she just telling me about the show? Why is she telling me how we should market it and make money on it?"
Right. This is totally out of sequence, but I'm curious if at New Form, what your response is to people pitching you like creative and business, a marketing plan. Yeah. Like, are you into that, or are you like, let us worry about that?
I mean, if the person's really into it, like, yeah, let's talk. You might have better ideas than me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to spend most of the meeting on that. And I think this is my lesson from, like, young Kathleen is because, like, if you're spending a ton of meeting talking about the marketing, you may not have spent enough time thinking about the story. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think sometimes it's fun to think about all the marketing and you miss, like, this character makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Or, like, you don't know the answer to fundamental things. Or there's no tension in the third act. If you're so obsessed with how it's marketed, you may not have spent enough time on the story.
And maybe you're just a marketer.
Yeah, right? That too.
Which is an okay thing to be.
Right.
Yeah.
But maybe, yeah, I guess. But so now going back to when you were pitching those things, I guess that's probably the reaction that people were having.
Yeah, exactly. You, like right? In retrospect, I'm like, oh, I kind of get why they didn't want to buy anything from me because it felt like I hadn't done the real work.
They also
or like you were passionate about
too many things.
Too many, yeah.
Yeah.
They haven't realized yet that things are broken, right? Like, yeah. The disruption is on its way, but it's not really there yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I remember I used to pitch, like, I'm like, and then we'll release it on a Wednesday, and I know how to get the thumbnail to be just right, you know? this was when you couldn't choose your own thumbnail.
Yeah, yeah.
There was an algorithm, right?
There was an algorithm to choose your thumbnail. That's
But, yeah. But I get it, too. Okay, so you didn't sell any TV shows, and then what happened?
And economy hit the shitter. I'd finished The All for Naughts. I went and worked on this TV show with David Blaine.
So. Was it mesmerizing? Do you know all the secrets?
I do know all the secrets.
You know how to levitate?
No, I do know a lot of the secrets. I'm so conflicted
right now.
Is he still doing stuff? It's been a while.
Not really.
Since After he's hung himself show. Over in New York.
That was my special.
Oh, that's fun.
I like lived in Central Park for 3 days. so I just went back to traditional television. And in the midst of all this stuff, I got to know this company, Next New Networks, and their founders, Herb Scannell, Fred Seibert, Tim Shea, Emil Rensing, and Jed Simmons. Like, we were all like in New York.
I always joke, it's like everyone was in the same building, right? Because NextNew was like in the same building as Tumblr and Vimeo. Is that right?
It's Tumblr and not as Vimeo, but as Boxy.
Yeah.
Remember Boxy? And Tumblr, David was an intern at NextNew Networks.
Awesome. Perfect.
Before he started Tumblr. So after I did that David Blaine special, Fred and Tim called me and they were like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm really tired. And they were like, just come into the office 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm. Wait, can I just make one other observation that I think is really common in this business is that you were like world famous for like a little while and then you just like went back to doing a job.
Production coordinator.
Yeah.
Which is just so. I got a better credit than that on that.
Which is just so common though, right? It's like this thing that people don't realize. Like the highs are so high and the lows are. Yeah.
I felt like such a badass. And then I was like,
yeah. And then someone random will call you and be like, what are you doing?
And then David Blaine screamed at me for 6 months of my life.
Well, that's probably why he couldn't hold his breath for long enough.
Get it together, David. And Fred and Tim were like, just come to the office.
And NextNew is kind of like an early TV, like they had shows basically, right?
So yeah, they had this idea that the internet would be the next cable.
Mm-hmm.
So like Fred and Herb and Jed were all, and Emil, Tim less so, Tim was more like internet-y,
mm-hmm.
Were all ex-Viacom executives or Turner executives.
Right.
And they were like, the internet is the next cable. There's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, if not infinite niche channels
right. With
super dedicated followings.
Right. And this is when Netflix was just DVDs in your mailbox.
Totally. And they were like, there'll be all these channels and we want to be the Viacom mm-hmm. of that era. And here's the plan. And they got really good at building channels. Like they had this channel Indie Mogul that was all about DIY filmmaking, mm-hmm. Epic Foo, Threadbanger, FLD, which was Fastlane Daily, car thing, and Barely Political, which was the people who made the I Got a Crush on Obama.
Right. They had that girl, right? That was
Obama
like
girl.
Pretty. Yeah.
Yeah. Amber.
Yes.
She was Obama girl. She had a crush on Obama.
Yeah.
But she had, I mean, that they like kind of like invented clickbait.
Totally. Yes. Ben would not feel great about you saying it. Ben Rellis, who started a Barely Political, would probably not feel great about being
called. Well, right. No, not.
But it really was about like her cute tits and an Obama t-shirt. And
right,
then
right.
You clicked on it because it was like, cute tits.
This is funny.
And then it was actually good.
Right. But every success story on the internet is like, we're trying to do A and then we accidentally do B and then B takes off.
Yeah.
You know, right.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're aiming to be clickbait, but you're realizing, wait, if we put her in the thumbnail, people watch this video.
The algorithm did us a favor, and now here we are.
Yeah.
So NextNew, you're making these shows.
Yeah, they brought me on. I started just hanging out and doing shit. And they had just hired the CEO to help them kind of advance the company further. And after about 9 months of me showing up at the office 3 days a week and just like helping out on shows mm-hmm. and doing branded content. And he was like, why don't you just run all of production and programming for us?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, do you have health insurance?
Sure. So it's this funny mixture of, we're on the forefront of a revolution. We all own our own media. We get to make whatever we want. Television is ours. And also no one's getting paid except for you. You know what I mean? There's a handful of people basically
doing this,
doing it. Yeah.
And I am conflicted because I'm like, or I could just go back and like be a writer's assistant and work my way up into a writer's room and do the thing that is the traditional path. But I'm applying for those jobs while I'm doing this 3 days a week at Next to Networks, and I'm not getting them because the producers on the TV shows are like, you made a show for Michael Eisner. You can't be my assistant.
Right, right.
Like, I can't. They like won't.
You should have taken it off your resume.
Yeah, like, they literally won't give me a job because they're like, this makes no sense.
Yeah.
You should have changed it to Cycle Meisner.
And I was, like, really frustrated. And so, and also, just, I hadn't been to a doctor in, like, 7 years. Like, yeah, my primary care physician for most of my time in New York was the Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, my lady parts did not fall out because of Planned Parenthood. Thank you.
Shout out.
Shout out to the Planned Parenthood on the Bowery. So I took it. And that was right when they decided to be what's called a multi-channel network.
MCN.
And MCN. And I half my job was like helping all the channels figure out how to produce more efficiently. Mm-hmm. Other half of my job was like branded entertainment pitches. And then the other half of my job, because it's a startup, you always have three jobs, was signing channels. Mm-hmm. Like finding cool shit. Was this pre-Maker
or post-Maker?
Same time as Maker. Like the Maker had launched and called themselves The Station. So this was when Maker was Phil DeFranco, the Fine Brothers.
Shane Dawson.
And Danny and Lisa. We were just starting to do this stuff. Like we were building this relationship with YouTube. And that was the era of the company. And then that was probably around 2009, almost 2010, like late 2009 when I started that job. And this whole time I'm like making comedy music videos on the side. I'm like writing stuff. I'm still trying to like hustle my shit. Right. And they told them that. I was like, I'm not going to stop doing this. You can't ever make me stop doing this. And they were like, we don't care. Why are you being so aggro?
Like, it's fine.
Then they got bought by YouTube.
Yeah.
In 2011.
So you become a part of YouTube, you are like instrumental in the YouTube space, all of that stuff. And then...
Wait, when you say YouTube space, you mean the sound stages?
Yeah, the deal with that is that literally this is the story, is that like the day after the acquisition, and like everyone's pumped, I'm like, I don't want to work for Google. Like I literally was sad. YouTube was
already Google at that time.
Yeah, because I was like, I don't want to work for a big company.
And you're still in New York at that point, right? Yeah.
And so I go into the office the next day. And I have a meeting with Fred Seibert. Many meetings with Fred Seibert involve people burying.
Wait, why did you not want to work for Google? That's like, I...
Because you want to be a writer and director and produce. You don't want to be...
New York bohemian lifestyle.
It's funny because I was an engineer, and that is like the holy grail of jobs. Like Apple, but Google.
It's still a giant company, and there was no... There was very explicitly at that time, and this gets like a little deep in the weeds, YouTube could not physically produce content because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and Safe Harbor. And so there was very explicitly... We are not buying you to make content. We are buying you to advise other people how to make content on YouTube.
Yeah, you guys had a killer deck, basically, that was like best practices.
It was like,
hey, you want to make a web series? Like, this is how you tag your videos smartly.
But they defined you as a non-creator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what bugged you.
Yeah. And they were like, all nice people.
It was illegal for you to
do. Yeah, it was like literally a threat to the existence of the
company.
And
they also probably owned anything you made. If you did make something.
Yes, but like, do they really care about that? No. But yes, Google owns everything you make if you are making their building with
it. If you've ever searched for it, they own it.
Yeah. And so I went into Fred's office and I was like, what am I going to do? And he was like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. He's like, well, you have time here and they want you to be here. So do what you want to do. And I said, I want them to make it easier for people like me to exist. So maybe we build studios all over the world and give them away for free.
That was your idea?
Yeah. And then I worked with this guy, Liam Collins, who was the COO, and Lance Podell, who was the CEO of Next New, to put together the whole plan. It was like my little mini MBA.
But at the time, were you like, this is just an insane idea I'm going to suggest? And then they're like, okay.
And then I spent 6 months building a PowerPoint deck. I didn't know how to do that. And a business model with Liam and Lance. And I went into a meeting and he basically said, build studios in London, Tokyo, Los Angeles, and New York. And I worked with, there's all these internal resources at Google that are like, if they let a producer go too wild, she will build four studios. Like, you sure. can find out anything you want. Like, I literally cold called this woman, Terry, and who works in real estate for Google. And I was like, how much do you think 50,000 square feet would cost in Los Angeles to rent? And she was like, what? And I was like, I just need to do a little research. And like,
and she's a resource for you to like figure that out, basically.
Everyone at Google is a resource for each other.
Yeah.
Like, that's the ad. And that's the amazing thing about the company. Like, if I wanted to cold email a software engineer, I would be like, what about this? Now, he may not respond to me.
Sure.
Or might not prioritize it.
He's a he.
Or she.
Okay.
But like, that is the attitude, is that like, we should all work together and be transparent and be collaborative.
Synergy.
And so 6 months later, I pitched it and they said yes in the room. And then I spent the next 2.5 years building studios in London, Tokyo, LA, and figuring out, okay, what does this mean to give away studios for free? Going back to the Safe Harbor and DMCA Act, the building of the studios existentially threatened all of YouTube because we were touching the content. Those were their words, not mine. Sure. Don't touch the content. And it was like a whole thing, but they had already said yes to it. So I had to deal with all the legal process. And I learned a lot and it was awesome, but it was insane and amazing and also completely utterly overwhelming and wonderful and crazy that they let me do that.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Wait, were you at YouTube when the Fine Brothers made My Music, when they were giving $1 million to all these different creators?
Was it My Music that I helped them with? There was they basically bought Next New Networks because they were like, we just told all these people they could have money to make YouTube channels.
Right, they have like Amy Poehler $1 million.
And then they were like,
random people, right?
They brought us into the company and they were like, look at all the things we greenlit. And for like half of them, we were like, cool. And for the other half, we were like, what the fuck did you do this? It won't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they didn't know how their own platform worked.
Right. Well, it seemed like they would give like random celebrities like $1 million. And then they would give people like the Fine Brothers, who really knew how to make YouTube videos, $1 million, but they'd say like, you have to make 300 hours of content.
They were all like pretty crazy content orders in that era. Like it was all pretty insane. It's just that the Fine Brothers got $1 million and other people got tens of millions of dollars.
Right, because they were
famous.
Same, even though the Fine Brothers had much more viewership on YouTube than Shaq.
Yeah. And I was, Next New was part of the reason some of those YouTube talent got funded channels, because we were like, why don't you give some money to the people who've actually built audience?
Right. Right.
And George Strompolis actually, like, he started a program that was the precursor to this before he left for Full Screen, which Next New Networks was a recipient of. So, like, everyone kind of was pushing for that same
idea.
Ultimate agenda.
Right. I mean, I feel like the whole story, this is just an epiphany I had right now, of like today's digital episodic like kind of infrastructure is YouTubers trying to convince people that they're legitimate. trying to convince traditional media, like, that they're legitimate filmmakers.
Sure, yeah.
And so it's like, look, we can use sound stages and we can have grips and we can do permits.
Yeah. And know? Well, and the crazy thing is when we opened the studio, it was like, come, and all the YouTubers were like, no.
Yeah, I don't trust this.
Now there's like a funny, I feel like there's the new generation of like kids who grew up watching YouTube who are like so excited to go to the space. Like, it's like Mecca.
I mean, the space is pretty awesome. I mean it's, no matter who you are.
Cool. Yeah, it's very cool. But I guess what I mean is like, there's a different, it's like you might as well be in the Walk of Fame. You might as well be in front of Grauman's. You know, like there's like a mythology to it now that's really interesting.
Or even like my 8-year-old nephew, over the last summer, we had like a little family reunion thing and I wore a YouTube Space baseball cap because I had worked there.
Sure.
Yeah, because you're on the YouTube Space baseball team.
Yeah. And he lost his shit.
Go playlist.
He was like, where'd you get that YouTube hat from? And my sister was like,
you're like, I invented YouTube.
She was like, Reed, your aunt used to work for YouTube. And he was like, what? He's like, can you get me one? It was hilarious. And great. I was like, yeah, I can get you a YouTube hat.
But I think maybe something to what you're touching on, Matt, is like, when the YouTube Space came out, there was this like feeling of like, what? This doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Are they going to own my stuff? Like, this seems too good to be true a little bit, you know?
Yeah. It was also, I had weird moments where like, there was this water.org video that Matt Damon made.
Sure. Yeah.
I think
Andy Riz, I think, shot some of that. Do you
oh, really?
Yeah.
In the building, right? When it first opened. And I remember having a conversation with the producer on it, being like, I was like, you got to sign this location agreement. And he, and like, this is the process. And he was like, well, I don't want to sign it. This clause of it, I want to edit it. And I was like, yeah, here's the deal. Like, there is no negotiating.
Yeah.
I was like, you sign this. and you get to space for free. And he's like, well, I'll pay you for the space so that I can edit it. And I was like, I have no capability of taking money from you.
Yeah.
So like, just sign, like, Google is not going to ever negotiate this with you because it is not worth their time.
Right. And they're not going to own anything. There's nothing bad about it.
Exactly. But they were like so confused by it all. The traditional people were really confused by it. The YouTubers were like, how do I use a stage?
Right.
Yeah.
We forgot that, like, yeah, you can have the space and you have all the equipment for free, but then you need to, like, production design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you need a crew.
And you need a crew. And, like, we built all this infrastructure to provide that for people, but it still wasn't enough.
Still. Yeah.
Well, I remember when the Fine Brothers, they shot my music there. It was crazy. And I went there and I was like, someone gave me a tour because, you know, you had to have, like, a certain number of subscribers or something to unlock the space or something. Yep. And they're like, yeah, you can shoot here. And I looked at it and I was just like, I just couldn't, like, wrap my mind around, like, how I would, like, get all this. Like, it was this free space, but you need to bring your crew and you need to have something. Yeah, it's like, it's perfect for if you're already doing that stuff and you need a space.
There was like faultiness in the premise, but there were also...
It was like too good to be true. Yeah. And that was what I was feeling at the time. I was like, this can't be. They also bring like Guillermo del Toro to build a set.
Yeah.
Like anyone can shoot on this amazing set.
Yeah, it's cool. Like, and it's fun. It is like a weird community to it.
Yeah, there was a vibe for sure.
A vibe. And I think it ebbs and flows just like any community. And it's been like, and they've built more since I left.
If our listeners, if you don't know about YouTube Spaces, you should definitely check it out.
Check it out.
And one of the most amazing, like the most socialist of... like internet.
From a massively capitalist company.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's insane. Like, hey, if you want to be a filmmaker and you need whatever you want, like, YouTube will give it to you.
In like a 10-hour slot, you've got it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but that was also like...
Oh yeah, there's like no after hours or no one can get into the building.
That was the thing. This is the thing I always use to illustrate the complication of the YouTube space. Yeah. So like I went to unlock the space or whatever, like after... You know, you have a certain number of subscribers in order to like be allowed to use anything. You have to just go through a training thing, which all makes sense. But the very end is the Q&A, basically, where you kind of just get to ask questions. And a lot of it's like how to not accidentally infringe on someone's copyright and stuff, you know, kind of training wheel stuff that makes complete sense if you're a corporation that needs to train, you know, tons of creators on how to make stuff. But at the end, I was like, what happens if we hit overtime? You guys haven't talked about that. And they were like, what? And I was like, you know, like...
you're running behind.
You're behind and you don't get all of the shots that you need and you need more time. Like after the 10 hours are done, after like when it's time to shut down, like is there a penalty or a strike system or how does that work? And they were like, what do you mean? And I was like, oh, this is a place run by engineers. It's like I'm asking... what if 2 + 2 didn't equal 4?
Yeah.
And that's you're done.
That is the challenge that like, that in a nutshell is the like issue with Hollywood and Silicon Valley.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. And it's, I call it the algorithmics versus the humanists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that is the battle over culture and media and in much more dramatic terms in the last year to 2 years, our politics. Are algorithms and engineering culture going to drive, how much of that is going to drive our culture and how much of it is going to be more human and what's the middle ground? And then also like, I think a lot about like, are the algorithms changing us?
Well, you should talk to Oren. He knows how to get the algorithm to give you the best thumbnail.
Yeah, it's all thumbnails, Kathleen.
It's all thumbnails. There's nothing really beyond it. Sadly, kind of all
my
thumbnails.
My old boss, sure. Chris Williams, do you know him?
Uh-huh.
Told me all that matters is the thumbnail.
Kind of.
It's the click.
And the first 15 seconds.
Yeah. We should talk a little
bit about new form, right?
About new form.
It took too long.
Yeah. No, no, no. This
it's
is
only
great.
Been an hour. So only your quick stuff.
I know.
This is...
I actually don't know... Where we do the jump from YouTube space to... Did you work for Imagination ever?
No, I took Ron on a tour of the YouTube space.
Ron Howard.
Yeah. I took Ron, this guy Ed Wilson, this guy Jim Wyatt, and Michael Rosenberg, who's the chairman of Imagine. I think that's his title now. On a tour of the YouTube space.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought nothing of it. I mean, I thought a lot about it. It was fucking cool. It's Ron Howard.
Super neat, yeah.
Super
and Imagination is Ron Howard's production.
Imagine.
Who's made movies like Cowboys and Aliens.
Come on, they have Apollo 13. Yeah. Beautiful Mind. Nutty Professor.
Basically, but like every Big like
Big, and Ron Arrested Howard. Development. Sure, yeah. Empire, like 8 Mile.
Yeah, yeah.
When you start actually listening, you're like, there's a you're bunch like, of really awesome shit, and there's also a bunch of stuff that you're like, Nutty Professor, why did you do that? Oh, okay. Or like awesome. The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. You have you watched that recently? Ooh, does not.
I actually did not see it.
But you know, listen, you got to keep the lights on, right?
Yeah,
the,
and also
those
like,
offices are very nice, right?
They are. They have new offices too that are lovely. I took them on a tour. I basically called my mom that night and was like, I met Ron Howard. Yay. I had already kind of mentally decided I wanted to
leave.
Was
your mom like, can you give me that $5,000 back?
I eventually paid them back when I got bought by YouTube. They were really grateful about that. And honestly, once I got a job at YouTube, they were just like, that's all they could tell people. And they would never tell people YouTube. They'd always be like, Google.
Yeah, sure.
And I'd always be like, well, I work at YouTube. And they'd be like, people would be like kind of disappointed. And I'd be like, it's owned by Google. It's right. Fine. I still have the Google
And
stock.
Your parents were like, but can you get a job at Yahoo?
I thought nothing of it. I didn't think anything would come of it other than like a good story about meeting Ron Howard. I'd already decided I wanted to leave YouTube. I literally had a countdown clock on my phone.
Can I ask you a side question? At this whole time that you were at Next New and then YouTube, were you directing or writing or doing any of that
stuff? I was writing a lot more than I was directing because it's a hell of a lot easier to make time for writing. I was directing a couple sketch comedy video stuff. I directed a pilot for New York Television Festival.
Oh, cool.
I did a bunch of stuff. Like, I did anything I could make enough time for.
Like, you were still into episodic comedy stuff was your thing?
Yeah. Although, like, increasingly, I'm, like, not... I'm interested in that, but I'm doing other stuff. Like, lately, I've been writing different stuff than that. I wrote a drama pilot this year.
And you've done music stuff, too, obviously.
Yeah. Well, although I'm not musical, I just like the world of music. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't really carry a tune or really have any rhythm. But I'm interested in that area. And I liked making music videos because mm-hmm. they're fun to make.
Yeah.
I met Ron. I was planning on leaving YouTube. I literally was like going to give notice no matter what. And the plan was to like go to Argentina for 3 months and learn the tango.
Oh, that sounds good. I want to know about your countdown clock actually on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So you, like you said, you know what, I'm going to quit in X number of days and you set a timer.
My first day of YouTube, I set a timer. I said I'd stay for 3 years and leave no matter what.
Gotcha.
Wow, that's a long timer.
Yeah, it was. But
Did
it was
you have
like
to keep your phone that whole time.
It's an app. Like I would just restart it if I got a new phone. And just with the idea that like I'm gonna do as much as I can in these 3 years, mm-hmm. and if I stay any longer, I might turn into a Google executive,
sure.
which is not what I wanted. And I would say like a year before the end, I took a lot of thought into like taking a moment to be like. Or I could stay here.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's a lot of really cool things about Google. Like I could have stayed there and decided that I wanted to work in like driverless cars
sure.
and move to London or Tokyo and like incredible place to work in that respect. And that was very seductive, but not more seductive and interesting to me than making things.
Sure. Yeah, you can pay for your own coffee and lunch.
Wait, so you could have been a Google Map car driver?
You can literally be like, that's the great thing about a company like that. And I don't think Google is alone in this. Is like, if you're in a big enough company like that, you can decide like, YouTube has been great. I want to go move laterally to this new tool because mm-hmm. I'm more interested in that. Or I want to move laterally because I want to go live in Buenos Aires.
Right. And Google is famous for encouraging that. Like Gmail totally. Came out of like someone...
Yeah.
That just like randomly was like, oh, well, even like a better email.
My
program.
Last year at YouTube or so, this woman, Diana, came to work in our group. And prior to working in our group, she worked directly for Marissa, a mayor for 7 yeah. years, and then decided that she wanted to be more in media and mm-hmm. ultimately a screenwriter. And we literally got a phone call from Eric Schmidt being like,
the
you
CEO
have a new,
Google.
Of Google at the time.
The Michael Eisner of Google.
Exactly. And he was like, you now have an extra head. We're like, what? And that's a big deal to get an extra head,
sure.
head count.
Right.
And we're like, why? And they're like, because Diana Lee wants to move to LA and explore what it means to work in media. And we're like, who? And she ended up being an incredible asset to our mm-hmm. team and is so brilliant. But it was like literally from on high. They were like, this person wants to explore and
Boop.
See what their next phase is.
Yeah.
Boop. Here's an extra resource. And she was a total badass and is a wonderful person and an amazing increasingly amazing writer and like really cool. Like, but that's the kind of people who work right. at Google. Like right. I will never work anywhere with anyone smarter or nicer than the people I worked with at Google. Right. Like it's kind of insane. Anyways, I had this countdown clock.
Yeah.
And then about 6 months after that tour, I was on a hike with a friend of mine who worked at CAA, Sarah Pass. She now works at Amazon. And she was like, your name came out of a meeting today. This is also what CAA is good at. Agents, they're good at information.
That's an awesome name for an agent, by the way.
Sarah Pass?
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Like, yeah. We've got a pass.
Yeah.
On the line. No. She wants to talk to you.
And she was like, your name came out of the meeting today. Ron, Howard, and Brian Grazer want you to run this company for them.
That is so crazy, though.
Off of a tour.
Did you say?
A tour and a resume. Right.
No, they had never seen my resume.
But, you know,
I'm sure CAA was like, she's amazing or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And they, you know.
But did they know about the Berg or any of that stuff?
No. They just knew that I was like a good executive, I think. I don't know.
They had to have like asked around, though. Like no one just says like, hey, we want you to run a brand new company without due diligence. Certainly not them, right?
There's not someone more steeped in traditional media than him. For him, probably like the digital world was probably like, yeah, giving tours is probably most of the work.
There was probably a certain element of like, we don't know anything about this world. This person seems to know a lot about it, but she CAA seems creative. And also, I wasn't the only candidate. I then went through like a 3 to 6 month process. And I think what won them over is that I kept saying, this is what I want to do. If you guys don't want to do this, like this is what I think I would do if I was running the company. If you don't want to do that, no harm, no foul. Tell me what you want to do. I will find the person who can do it for you because you will never meet anyone who knows more people in digital media than this woman.
That's a good pitch. I should use that in like regular pitches. Like this is the way I want to do the show. If you guys don't want to do it this way, then I'll recommend someone else. But this is the way I want to do the show. And then
it's a strong position. Yeah. You have to be willing
even
to
walk away.
Even if
they're agreeing with you the whole time.
You know, and then after that whole process, we started the company. It was really...
And that company was Nuform.
And our mission
was... And where did the name come from?
They had it. Was
there a Form Digital?
It was originally the Nuform Digital.
Yeah, right? And then I dropped the digital after 18 months.
Yeah.
When we sold a TV show.
NFD, right?
And if we'd often call it NFD. I didn't like the name. In fact, right before we announced the company, I did a last minute huge pitch to be like, here are 60 names I come up. I've cleared them all. Yeah. I own the L. I own the domain.
Kathleen Grace Digital, K Grace Digital, Kathleen G Digital.
But ultimately, I think it kind of ended up working.
For our listeners that don't know what Nuform is, what is Nuform?
We are a digital studio developing mobile first content for the next generation. So it's really all about emerging voices and formats.
Has it always been mobile first? Or?
Yeah, that feels like.
It's probably in the last two and a half, three years. That's my way of saying it because I think the reason I think about it mobile first is like it's not short form. It's anything you discover and consume initially on your phone, and that can be long form. And this audience finds everything and consumes everything on their phone, even if it's Netflix, even if it's YouTube. Final Space on TBS.
So in a sense, saying mobile first just means media.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But it's different than...
It means we're not afraid of vertical video, folks.
And I'm not afraid of like social platforms. And I understand how people consume and find content. And that actually fundamentally, in my opinion, affects how you develop. Mm-hmm. Because if you have no guaranteed audience, there's no lead-in audience in digital.
Right.
And there's no lead-in audience on Netflix. Sure. Like,
even though the whole idea of like an MCN is to be a lead-in, is to create lead-in audience.
You have to develop differently, and the whole creative process is different. And I think you have to. You always have to think about marketing on traditional television, but in a way, you have to think about it way earlier in the process if you want to have a successful show in this day and age. And it's not just because it's on your phone; it's because there's like audiences are incredibly fragmented, and so. You have to kind of already know your audience before you have made the show or even thought of the logline
I'm curious if that's like evolved. Like when we did Miss 2059, like 3 years ago now, I know because my daughter is 3 years old.
Oh my God.
As of last week. Like at that time, casting was like a big element of.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Of getting people to watch your show. Like if we get this person that has 2 million subscribers.
That's what we all thought.
I mean, I guess in my mind, it was like, well, she's a makeup vlogger. Like she's not an actress, right? Wouldn't we rather get. Like a good actress. But what's kind of the current strategy, the stuff that you see is working?
I think it's the stuff that is, there is something very timely, hooky, and relevant about the world that is easy to talk about and shareable. Okay. And so I don't think it's necessarily cast a huge actress, although I think when you're thinking about marketing and standing out, it helps. And I don't necessarily think that means as a social media person, it could be Sandra Bullock in the like Bird Box, because she's relevant to a certain audience. But it has to be easy to talk about. It has to have a kind of a core audience you know you're gunning for, and malleable in the sense that people can like take this idea and make it their own. Like the Bird Box thing is a really weird example, but good. Like Netflix had this instinct, I'm sure backed up by data, that like people are really into apocalypse stories. Mm-hmm. And then they also know that people really love Sandra Bullock. And then they also can unknowingly unleash this thing, which is like, oh, there's this very simple visual kind of meme-y thing about the premise. Mm-hmm. Which is there's this box and you're blind,
like a Quiet Place, but with
exactly and there was something very simple and easily transmitted through social media and word of mouth that helped that kind of be. And they also featured it on the freaking homepage for like a month.
But yeah. Let me ask you this: do you think that all those things you just said about what makes a show catch on now, do they not all apply to traditional media nowadays also?
I think increasingly they do apply to traditional media. And that's why I'm like, that's why I say mobile first, because social first is it's like, that is media. And if you're not doing that on TV, your TV show is not getting ratings either, but your TV show is also not getting ratings because of the technology, meaning like people don't watch TV. Like,
right. I guess what you said earlier maybe is that in TV, people find your show in a different way, right? The famous like George Costanza line is like, why are people going to watch our show? Because it's on TV.
Yeah.
Right. And on the internet, that's not the case.
No. It's BYOA, bring your own audience.
BYOA.
Yeah. For everything. And yes. that's the really frustrating part, I think, for everyone in media right now is like, even if you're Will Smith.
Sure.
Like, you're not guaranteed an audience is going to show up to watch you jump out of a plane on YouTube.
Yeah, but I bet if you're Sam Smith, they would watch it. So we've had this debate a lot on the podcast of like how important as a filmmaker bringing your BYOA-ing is.
Right.
Like if you want to make a feature film, how much do you need to bring your own audience? Because we've heard definitely both versions. Like all you have to think about is bring your audience. Who was... Seed and Spark, do you know?
Sure, that? Emily Bastard. Like,
yeah, well, so
that's
big.
That's their jam.
Right. Sure. And then there's like the guys from Short of the Week that are like, no, just make something amazing and like don't worry about anything else. So what's your, I mean, obviously they're both right to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think they're both right to a certain degree. I think that filmmakers have to get used to the idea that it's a lot harder to be like a isolated auteur version of a filmmaker now. And I think that's okay, because isn't the point to be in conversation with the world?
Right.
Not everyone has to be a like rabid marketer, though, because that's exhausting.
Yeah, that's the tricky part.
And like,
right?
If you spend too much time on that, the story might not be good.
Yeah.
My pitch is always like, find the things that you're excited about talking about and doing, in addition to telling the story, and hopefully find a partner who is like really interested in helping you find audience and like think that through.
I think about with Squaresville. Like, I shot and finished that entire first season and then basically spent the same amount of time marketing it every more. I stopped writing and started, like, hanging out on whatever. Tweeting. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, signing up for,
but do you think,
real SEO newsletters or whatever.
Do you think that show did well because you were lucky that it found that an audience existed? Or do you think you were like, there's an audience for this?
I 100% knew that there was space on the board. Like, at the time, people were not making, like, premium scripted content for young, smart, bookish women, basically.
Yeah, book girls.
Yeah. Like nerd girls did not exist. I literally, like, drew a picture of, like...
You were going to Tumblr, you typed nerdy girls, and nothing came up.
Nothing came up. But, like, Tumblr was, like, a big part of the whole... Mm-hmm. The whole marketing campaign. And, like, also spending time on that site helped me refine... what it was that, like, the language that they spoke, you know what I mean? Like,
right. They ship people.
Yeah, exactly. Like, building, like, gifts and things like that wasn't something that natively occurred to me, you know?
Yeah.
But engaging with a fan base literally every single day for 2 years basically is what helped make that show successful. So it was both the opportunity, like knowing that there was an audience out there that was hungry for it, but also relating to them on their terms.
Yeah. Right. I think the biggest advice I give to people when thinking about the internet and how to create content for it is like, the internet's a really cool house party. Follow the rules of the house party. When you go to a house, you bring something cool, like something tasty to drink or eat.
Yeah.
You talk about things other than yourself. And you engage in a conversation and you don't shout at people.
Right. And you lie to your parents about where you're at.
Totally. So like that is the rules.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
bring something cool, talk about other things, and don't shout at people. Because that's the thing I think people mess up is the third thing is they're like, well, if I just shout enough about my show, people will watch it. And you're like, no. Like what you did, engage with them in their own. You were coming to their party.
Right.
And identify the right party.
And so are you saying like YouTube is a party?
Yeah, it's all a part. The whole internet is a part. I mean, YouTube's sometimes a pretty terrible party, depending on what parts of YouTube you're in. But like, YouTube's a party. But even like how you should build audience and converse and think about content in the space of social media is like, don't. I think it's really hard to be a filmmaker now who only wants to make stuff for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or maybe that's a myth. Maybe those filmmakers don't exist. But there was this myth of like, I'm going to make something.
I just make myself laugh.
Yeah, or like, yeah. I'm just making things I'm interested in. And I'm like, cool, you could also just be experimental video artists and do that too. And there's a difference.
Right. I think also it's easy to confuse specificity for self-indulgence, right?
Yes.
And so like...
Envision,
right, sure. Yeah. So making a thing that is special and unique because it's specific in a different way is more relatable to everyone. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When you go broad, no one can relate to anything, right? But that doesn't mean that sometimes you still have to pull your head out of your ass, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically like, listen to notes, right?
Be collaborative.
Yeah, sure.
Listen to notes. Or give yourself hard notes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's, I think, the hardest part when you're in this like early stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how do you know it's good? I mean, we really lucked out on the Berg in some ways. Like Matt and Tom had this really specific interest. Like we were a good balancing foil to each other, the three of us.
But you were also like immersed in a world and you didn't overthink it, right? You just made a show about it.
Yeah. The crazy thing about going back and looking at old episodes of the Berg is like all the shit that we used to make fun of that neighborhood has come true.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like, in a really eerie way. Like stuff that we were like, this would never happen, happens.
Right. Like now. You're exaggerating things and then it happened.
It all happened.
Well, so where are you guys, what are you doing today? Did you guys just get